Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Now, we do swear a little in this podcast, and there are some adult themes discussed.
So, like, I will be nodding a lot.
Okay.
Means I'm engaged and I'm listening.
That's you engaged. And if you're not nodding, that's
if I'm not nodding, you've lost me and you need to add. Okay.
No worries.
Welcome to the Talentworks podcast. I'm Shukri.
I'm Katrina.
And I'm Helen. BBC Studios is the production part of the BBC Group. So we're not public service. What we do at BBC Studios is we invest in and we produce amazing shows, both for the UK and globally. We make some shows for the BBC, but we also make them for the market, like Netflix, Channel 4, Spotify, Audible. These include Blue Planet,
Pressed,
Killing Eve,
Strictly Come Dancing,
I May Destroy You,
Doctor Who, Top Gear.
BBC Studios Talentworks are a small but mighty development team within BBC Studios. We work cross-genre and cross-platform. We specifically work with emerging talent, so we look to places like Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube, people who are writing blogs, maybe people who've got podcasts already, who are storytellers and looking to partner with BBC Studios to tell bigger, bolder stories.
In short, we play Cupid for talent and industry.
And this podcast is about giving the floor to some of those talented creators.
True to form, our guests are going to lead the way.
They are going to be telling us about three pieces of work that have defined their careers so far.
So who have we got today?
Shukri here. It's October 2022 and today I'm joined by Max Tobin.
They always come quite naturally. I'm perpetually in a state of writing about something that is causing me some kind of problem or stressing me out a little bit. That's normally when the idea happens. I'll just be thinking about it so much that naturally I'll like find myself accidentally externalising it into some sort of character.
Max is an award-winning filmmaker and presenter from Birmingham. Max has been making short films for over 10 years. His films have won Royal Television Society Awards and have been screened at a number of festivals, including the Aesthetica Short Film Festival, the New Renaissance Film Festival, and the Birmingham Film Festival. In 2020, Max became an overnight sensation on TikTok, gaining over 300,000 followers. So we know Max as he was selected to join BBC Studios' Factual team as one of their creators in residence. During the six-month residency, the creators received training and advice from industry professionals at BBC Studios whilst they developed new show ideas. So today, we're going to discuss, firstly, his creative inspirations and how they've changed in the last 10 years since he's been filmmaking. Next, how Max became an overnight TikTok sensation. And finally, what he has learned about documentary making from the Factual Science team at BBC Studios. Welcome to the Talentworks podcast, Max.
Thank you for having me, Shukri.
First things first, can you sum up what you do?
Yeah, so I am a resident creator at the BBC, or was. So I'm a filmmaker and I guess sort of a journalist, and I've been working with the BBC for the last year or so.
Let's get into your first clip. This is meant to represent your earliest creative work. What have you got for us?
It's a snippet from a film I made that's called Everyone in This Film is Dying. And it's a short film I made at university. It's a spooky Halloween-y short film.
I'm Arthur I. Elliot Chains, and this is your soothing meditation mix.
Yo, can I come in?
Yeah.
Right, weirdo?
No.
Right, cool. How you doing, man?
I am deeply unhappy.
Sweet, sweet. Hey, can I borrow your laundry card? I'm out of credit.
Oh, thanks, man. Girl was like, oh, Mick, your sheets are gross. So I needed a change of it tonight.
So have you had any luck recently? You know, with the ladies?
You seen a girl tonight, Mick?
Yeah, I pulled last night, actually. Oh, gotta get ready for round two.
on, Mick.
Hey, I don't kiss and tell, mate. Plus, you might know her. Oh, the club last night was so expensive. £5 for one Jaeger bomb. Like, what are they doing?
Sit down. Now stand up. Be nice to people you hate. No, Nigel. That's just not you. The leap, Nigel. Take it.
What's it like hearing that back?
Distressing. That was that was a long time ago. It's distressing hearing it back.
What made you get into filmmaking?
I was doing it when I was really little. I was an enormous attention seeker as a child. And from quite early on, I don't know, I think my parents bought me like a camera for Christmas, like a really, really terrible camera. And I just started filming. Me and my friends would just like film each other fighting most of the time. And then I just didn't grow out of it. And then the fighting just became part of like slowly more theatrical short films. And then it just never ended. So by the time I was at uni, I'd been making films technically for like, I don't know, like a decade. And there wasn't really a clear moment where I was like, oh, I'll take film seriously. It was just a sort of natural descent. Is how it felt.
So in this film, there's a lot of blood. There's a lot of gore. Mm. I'm interested to know what were some of your influences during that time and how has that changed?
I think when I was at that age, like my influences were more, had the sort of classic 18-year-old boy, like, you know, I liked Tarantino and stuff like that. And I liked sort of like violent cinema. But I know, I feel like my references changed quite a lot after that. I think the films I was making like early on, it was just like fun excuses to shoot, yeah, murder scenes and silly stuff. Whereas I think later on, like now I'm only really interested in like very small microcosmic things. So yeah, I don't know. The references back then, God knows, ones that I probably don't enjoy anywhere near as much now.
Interesting. Who do you draw influence from now?
Now, oh man, I really like Ruben Östlund.
Ah, okay.
Like the guy that made like Force Majeure and The Square and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I really love that, the sort of awkward nastiness of a lot of Scandinavian cinema and the commentaries on like sort of like politeness and typical family units and stuff. So yeah. I think I like directors who really, really don't partition comedy and tragedy, where like everything you're watching is like you're never sure whether you should laugh or cry. And there aren't moments that are like specifically designated as this is funny or this is sad. They just sort of bleed into one another. I think that's beautiful. The line between sort of like tragedy and farce being non-existent or continually sort of blurred.
Yeah, that is such a fine line, isn't it? It's such an art to like reach that.
Definitely. I think it's so rare that directors can like manage it, because it's such a fine-tuned combination of like performance, of editing style, of script. Like there's so much that has to happen for you to hit that perfect mark in the middle, and I do think it's incredibly rare. But yeah, so I think at the moment, like, that's what I'm most into, sort of like awkwardness and the line between something that's very, very dark and nasty and bleak and very funny and sometimes sweet and uplifting. I don't know, I like the in-betweens.
Yeah, that's very Scandi, actually.
It's very, very super Scandi. Yeah. That's so true.
I love it. So a lot of the comments on your film on YouTube mention the soundtrack. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Tell us a bit about how music features in your work.
Yeah, so my family are all quite musical, and I'm the least musical one.
That's not true, is it, Max?
It is true. It is true. They're all excellent, and they're all musicians in a sort of traditional being good at music way. But I obviously desperately wanted some kind of attention for my musical ability, but I couldn't really pick any instruments that had already been played by the rest of my family, because otherwise they'd be better than me at all of them. So I chose to start making these awful, awful like synth songs. Got really into my synths, because mm-hmm. I was like, you don't want to play the synth because you know how shit it sounds. So if I get really into the synth, no one can be like, that's not good, you're not good, because I'll be like, well, it's my own thing, you don't know your way around a fucking synth. So I started making synth music, and I started using it in all my films, and all my films have these like often quite repellent and strange synth soundtracks, which I really, you know, I think they're fun.
the king of synths,
mate. There's and there is a perverse psychology to the king of synths. It's not good. It's not healthy.
I have so many follow-up questions.
Ask all of them.
One is, What effect do you think the synth sound adds?
It's like a lot of my films are already so strange and weird that I think I have a composer now called George Dimitriou, who's like wonderful and who shares my love for sort synths. Of weird and nasty synths and samplers. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know, like the last film we made was described as at one film festival. We haven't released it yet, but as an assault on the senses.
Wow.
And it was not a pleasant review.
You should put that on the poster.
We absolutely should. Mm-hmm. One star, an assault on the senses. I think we love making films. I think the effect for us is a lot of the time like using the synths less as like a scoring device mm-hmm. and more as like a sort of, I don't know, as like a character, seeing it as like something that can like send a scene into like absolute blind fury, or like can sort of cover dialogue to the point where you're catching the odd word, which really, really angers people when they're watching films. They're like, why can't I hear every little thing? But it's like, you know, you miss words in conversation normally. So I quite like sometimes this idea of like, if it's not a conversation that you need to be hearing, the idea of like the synth going beyond just underlying what's going on in the film and becoming part of just like a general feeling and sensation, and sometimes even blurring into like being too loud for you to hear the dialogue, which again, I know people have very strong feelings about.
Yeah, I might be one of those people. So let's move on to your next clip. The most significant moment in your career. Talk us through it.
So this is a clip from a film called I Will Despise You. And it's a short film I made about 2 years ago, just before the pandemic, back when I was living in Birmingham. It's about two sort of yuppies on a date who decide to try and fall in love by listing all of their flaws and sort of fall in love with each other's vulnerability. Or do they?
Dum, dum, dum.
Dum, dum, dum.
No, no, I mean, no, it's fine. I spent 9 hours making sure I didn't put photos on with friends that were hotter than me.
9 hours?
Yeah, I'm one of them. Yes, I am. Some kind of game.
It's like a little game of how shitty I'll be.
Yeah, kind of fucked up first date.
Yeah, but yeah. I kind of like.
No, me too. Mm-hmm. More flaws, you go.
More flaws?
Yeah, more flaws.
Where do I start? I suppose I'm insecure.
No.
Not allowed?
Everyone. It's insecure.
Everyone's insecure.
Everyone.
Yeah, everyone's insecure.
No, they are.
Yeah, but I just don't like being around people who are comfortable in their own skin. Like, even my friends, I just hate it.
Oh, relentless empathy. All right, yeah. Okay.
Your turn.
Okay, I have a big complex.
Yeah?
Yeah, with other blonde women.
Blonde women?
Yeah, so if we were to date, and you have any blonde female friends, then I'll fucking murder them.
Murder them.
In the night.
It's okay, I'll secretly hate 90% of your male friends.
Really?
So Max, just one question off the bat.
Yeah.
Is this how most of your dates go?
You know what, there was a period where when I was writing it when I was having a lot of weird and draining and confusing dates. But what's more funny is that like since I've made that film, it's become the nastiest self-fulfilling prophecy. Because obviously women find out about the film and then they watch it, and then it's obviously a very funny thing to replicate on a date. So it's punished me more since making it, actually, bizarrely. Some of my dates do go that way because people find it funny to be like, ha, look, doing the thing from your film. It's like, very good.
I very see what good. You did there.
Yeah.
So like, what inspired the short film? Was it your interesting dates?
Sort of. I only remembered this recently. I was so miserable at the time of making that film. So this was 2 years ago. I'd come out of uni, and after 3 years of being told what a good little boy I was on my uni course, I found I could not for the life of me get a job. I got a job selling TVs, so I worked 5 days a week, but all weekends. I was living at home. My friend had come to stay in my family home, and then my other family came back, to the point where for a while we were sharing a bed. And every single night I'd get blind drunk. And then in the morning, like with my friend, we'd just like eat pork scratchings and drink like pints of gin and tonic. And then I'd get up at like 7 and go sell TVs. And I got rejected from so many jobs that I believed it was just an immutable fact that I was unemployable and thick. And throughout that period, I went on a lot of dates because I was bored. And like, yeah, I guess like fell into this trope of like, oh, I guess it's like, I don't know, I was questioning, like, is it good to be, like, honest on dates? And I think because I was feeling unhappy, I was finding it funny to be self-deprecating and miserable and to list all my flaws. And I, a lot of the time, found it was funny because, like, then it's reciprocated. So, yeah, you just end up with this situation where, like, you can end up quickly having a game of, like, who's the worst person? And I was at a stage in my life where I felt like a particularly bad and pathetic person. So I think, yeah, I don't know, it just came out of that. It came out of this quite miserable space, which is so funny now because I realise how happy making that film made me. Throughout that period, it was a real lifeline.
I want to know, how do you go about starting film?
I guess normally the process, it starts with obviously the idea stage, normally like some sort of problem I've been having that I want to sort of work through in a film. And then it'll take quite a while for me to then maybe like formulate it in my head, normally without writing anything down. And then eventually I'll sit down and it'll get written for me normally very quickly. But after like weeks or months of thinking about it. And then from there, like, yeah, it is a long process because it's like you got to find the money. I mean, like, I Will Despise You, that film was like, you know, yeah, we funded it. We just paid for it ourselves. And I just tried to sell as many TVs as I could and make a little bit more money to fund it. And that, like, you know, that took a while. And then you got to be so careful with the budget. We filmed the whole thing in like 2 days. And yeah, you've got to organize so much stuff. And it becomes, especially with a low budget film, weeks of planning. And then you just compress into like 2 days of shooting because filming is so expensive because you're paying for everyone's time and accommodation and for food and for the actors' day rates and for all the equipment you're renting. So it's like, you know, you plan for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and you're as meticulous as possible. And then you have 2 days where everything can just be fucked up. And really, as a director, like on set, a lot of your work is like pre-done. You know, if you've had rehearsals with the actors and like the two actors in that, Kel Chambers and Daisy Manda, they were both amazing. So it's like, I know that the acting is going to be great. The script I've already written. I've got an amazing DOP, an amazing editor, amazing producers, amazing sound recorders. It's like, then your job is to just like make sure nothing fucks up. And the only thing you can do as a director is make sure nothing fucks up. It's like the only way you can do your job properly is if nothing goes wrong. Then you just spend 2 days sort of being generally stressed and sort of checking that everyone's all right. And if you've got a good crew, it almost moves without you. It's a very interesting role. So yeah, and there is like so much hard work, and but it's really weird. I feel like the director's role is odd because it's like in those 2 days, the people that are doing that sort of more technically skilled jobs, it's like, yeah, there's an incredible amount of stress to get everything right that I don't have to necessarily be part of. And I'm just sort of sitting there worrying about time and making minute changes to performances that are already pretty good. And then moving shots around as everything falls apart, as it often does, and you don't have time to get everything you wanted. So yeah, in terms of the hard work, I guess those are the areas that are difficult.
I'm also interested to hear a little bit more about like your ideas stage. Like, how do you come up with the ideas? Do they come to you most of the time? Like, you're in the shower, right before you're about to go to sleep? Like, how do you form something into a script?
I feel like they always come quite naturally. I'm perpetually in a state of writing about something that is causing me some kind of problem or stressing me out a little bit. That's normally when the idea happens. I'll just be thinking about it so much that naturally I'll like find myself accidentally externalizing it into some sort of character. So I don't know, I see it as just a pretty easy and natural process, but that's because I exclusively write about things that bother me, which I also think is why my films have taken a bit of a bleak turn in the last few years.
I don't want to say anything, but everyone in this film is dying and I Will Despise You aren't the chirpiest.
They're not the chirpiest. And you know
titles?
What? They are happy films in comparison. The last one I made is called Man Sells Drink. It's vile. I haven't released it yet. I think it's funny. We submitted it to festivals as a comedy and it got removed from the comedy category and was played as drama and horror. Okay. We thought it was funny, man. Me and Kel, the main actor, thought it was the funniest thing. No one else did. And the stuff I'm writing at the moment, yeah, is normally... But it's not all that. It's not all bleak. It's like, you know...
What's the worst thing that's ever happened to you on a shoot?
I was once making an advert for like a farming recruitment company.
That's very niche.
Very niche. And what happened was we got robbed. The equipment we rented got robbed.
What?
I can't remember the exact value of the equipment, but I'm pretty sure it was in the 200 grand region. Or maybe 100 grand.
God.
I can't. It's been such a long time. Give or take 100 grand. And basically, it had been robbed from me and my producer had walked into a hotel and briefly left it in his car, but had unknowingly been tailed by some professional thieves because we were in London near Finsbury Park.
As
I should have known, London is, you know, it's there are some really good thieves in London. They're very skilled.
Yeah, they are skilled.
Erudite people.
By the way, Max is from Birmingham.
Yeah,
so
I'm from
he's
Birmingham.
Very new to this London life.
The green pastures of Birmingham, you know, everyone's sweet as cookies there. But here in London, frightening. So these men broke into the car and they robbed it all. And then the police turned up, and then we were sort of like, oh, this isn't very nice.
To happen.
And then the insurance company were like, oh yeah, so like you just owe us 100 grand now because you left it in a car and you're not insured. And every single week that is gonna increase by 2 grand as a loss of hire charge. So that was interesting news to hear as someone that had like, you know, maybe 60 quid in their savings after like spunking the rest of it on some stupid film. I was like, oh, good. That's nice. That's a nice bit of debt to be saddled with.
That is really unfortunate. Max.
Yes.
Imagine this. Mm-hmm. Someone very rich comes to you. Mm-hmm. Let's say Jeff Bezos.
Oh, wow.
Says Max.
Yeah.
I'm not going to build that spaceship right now. Mm-hmm. I've got unlimited funds mm-hmm. that I could spare you. Mm-hmm. What would you have done differently if you had all of this unlimited money from Jeff Bezos?
Oh, man. I mean, like, I'd be so terrified, I think, working with like a massive budget because I'm so used to like smaller things. At the moment, I'm writing something that I think is quite fun, which is about a sort of like swingers retreat that a load of couples go on, these sort of like British couples from various parts of the UK. They have this sort of rapidly declining situation where they're sort of getting picked off one by one by this sort of like Puritan cult. That's something I find very fun. So I guess that's what I would write. It's something I'm interested in at the moment, and I would like to have money to make something sort of slightly bigger in scale. But I don't want to make anything crazy. You know, if he was like, I'll have millions and millions and millions, I would still rather make something on a pretty cheap budget and have a lot of money to distribute it. Like, that'd be meant. Mm-hmm. I'm not too fussed about making, like, I've never been interested in like big budget, and like, I'm just so uninterested in films with like a big scale or like a big, like, you know, films about the potential end of the world, mm-hmm. or films about like, I don't know, like the destruction of a city, or even films about like wars and stuff. I don't know. I'm just really interested in like just really, really caring and feeling like desperate sort of empathy for like just a couple of characters is what I'm fascinated by. So I feel like I would never really be interested in making something like super expensive, but I'd love to make my swinger retreat murder film that I'm really, really interested in at the moment.
Yeah, you're not asking for too much.
I'd be like, Jeff, look, buddy, I'm a goofy little guy that's like literally could not be asking for less.
I can't wait for the future where this soundbite of you saying I have no interest in making big budget films is used against you.
I can't wait for that.
When you become the next Christopher Nolan. Yeah, I look forward to that. I can't wait for you to be doing those interviews and they pull out these receipts.
This podcast is going to ruin my career.
Essentially,
before it's begun.
Essentially, yes. Wow. Okay, let's fast forward into the present. What's your third clip?
So my third clip is what I've been working on at the moment. It's a BBC reel. So it's a sort of like short documentary about death and dying. And this is more representative of what I've been doing recently, which is science journalism rather than film, although the two have overlapped a little bit.
Ah, life. That thing where you're born and then get slightly bigger, fall in love with a person or fishing, maybe make some more little people, and then before you know it, it's time for the next part. Death, dying, the inevitable demise of our being.
Now, there's an eclectic range of ways you could die. It's quite commonly heart disease or cancer, but equally, you could join the 600-ish yearly victims of autoerotic asphyxiation. I don't know you. No matter how you die, at some point you'll experience clinical death, which is sort of like life, but just without breathing or blood circulation. In other words, it's the beginning of the passage from this life into that other bit.
But for most people, death isn't completely instantaneous. So what can modern science tell us about the experience of those very final moments? What does it feel like to die?
Okay, Max, this is your third clip. And just, I would like to address the elephant in the room. What is this obsession with death?
Oh, man, I love death. I'm so fascinated by death. I have been for such a long time too.
Interesting. By the way, I really love this film. Everybody should go check it out. It's on BBC Reels website and YouTube channel. I thought it did just what you described earlier of it being really funny, but really dark.
Thank you very much. That's very sweet.
Just touching back on your residency, can you tell us a little bit more about how you got the residency?
Yeah, sure. So I was at another company and I was directing sort of like adverts for like social media. And at some point I ended up working for TikTok. I ended up making TikToks for TikTok. educational stuff on like science and history and stuff. I didn't have any qualifications, but they were enjoying sort of like, they wanted to, you know, to have more educational content on the platform. Yeah, so I was working for TikTok and I was making like sort of science content in particular. That was like the content that sort of went a little bit viral. And I only got the, like, I was asked by my company to make this pitch for TikTok, and I did it in a sort of sarcastic and very reluctant way because I was like, I don't like TikTok or what it stands for. And then unfortunately they liked it, and I had to do that full time as a job for like 6 months.
Oh, that is really unfortunate. Sorry yeah, about that.
No, that's absolutely fine. I led this like a very strange existence, sort of like, you know, getting up and doing a couple of hours in front of a sort of this phone. It was during COVID. So being trapped in this room, filming these TikToks, slowly losing my mind. Then at some point, the BBC saw the TikToks, and Zoe Heron, who's an exec in the science unit, was very, very kind and asked me to do a residency here, at which point I have been able to make much, much, much better content with her and the rest of the team on the digital science unit.
So you were in the factual science team. Can you talk us through like a day in the life?
What's great about the digital science unit is like I've been able to cover a lot of different topics. So I've done a sort of series for BBC Earth Lab, which is like their sort of YouTube channel, on the same sort of thing, like phenomenological experience. I've been doing like an episode on vision, an episode on like the self, an episode on time, and looking at where our human experience of these things diverges from the actual things in question from a scientific perspective. So in terms of day in the life, it's, you know, it's been crazy. Sometimes I get to go and travel somewhere and interview like a physicist in their home, or some eminent social psychologist will sort of like meet me in a studio. That's always amazing. Sometimes it's just research and it's reading science papers and it's putting it together. Sometimes it's composing a bit of music for the edit, or doing the edit or the color grade, or being in a studio and filming piece to cams. And a lot of the time we try to dramatize and visualize what's going on in like sort of quite silly, stupid ways. So there's a lot of that. We did an episode on love. So I went on a date with a girl and we were trying to measure her pupil dilation. So we attached a sort of light to her head so that we could see her pupils very clearly, and then attached a camera next to her. And then I did the 36 questions to fall in love, which is sort of this like,
oh, wow,
social technique. And then I sort of, yeah, I was deliberately acting a bit weird to make the video funnier. That was a very interesting day.
So. I can imagine. Okay, what are things you've learned about television production that you didn't know before this residency?
I think the main one, it's been very specific to the BBC, but learning the sort of editorial guidelines and values. Because I was previously doing sort of like, you know, sort of half journalism, but there was no one was paying that much attention. So it wasn't like I would, you know, lie. I'd get to like sort of do my own thing and be like, well, this person says this and this person says this. And I think, and I'd sort of, you know, there'd be a lot of conjecture and it's like a bit fast and loose with like, you know, like being opinionated and with making mean jokes at the expense of politicians. And I obviously cannot do that at the BBC. But the further than that, the BBC's taught me the sort of importance of like really, really rigorous fact checking and really sort of rigorous attempts to achieve impartiality, which is difficult and a whole philosophical field in itself in terms of what that word means. But I think the way the BBC strives towards it is really impressive, and it did fundamentally change the way I thought I should approach journalism.
We ask every guest to look into the crystal ball of their future.
Oh,
spooky. What do you see, Max? What do you see?
Is it a nice crystal ball or a mean one?
Define what you mean by mean.
Well, you know, I feel like there's a chaotic web of futures, light and dark, Chukri, that I...
What's your ideal? I'm assuming your ideal would be the light one and not yeah, the dark one, no, but that is an assumption that I'm making.
Why would you assume that? Yeah, I guess like in terms of like perfect future, yeah, I would love to be directing for TV. I'd love to still be continuing to appear in front of the camera because it's something I find very fun. Yeah, maybe film too. Yeah, I'd like to be like writing stories that a lot of people can watch. I think that would be really nice. I think it'd be great to have a wider pool of like of feedback, positive and negative. To have people just engaging with my work in some way would be so nice. But of course, I'd rather be in the dark one.
Well, thanks, Max. We've come to the end of the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming and being our wonderful guest. Any last words?
Why are you going to do something?
Any words of advice?
Advice to...
Yeah, to, you know, uni students right now that are making their uni student films with a tiny, tiny budget.
Oh, just make the most of your friends not needing that much sleep and not working, and make them make films with you, and make sure there's alcohol on set, because you can make a lot of stuff and you can learn a lot from it.
Great, thank you.
Is that okay?
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you're interested in knowing more about Max, you can find him on Instagram at Max Tobin. That's M-A-X-X-T-O-B-I-N. You can also find us at BBC Studios Talentworks. This has been a Curly Media production on behalf of BBC Studios. See you next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.